From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Countries around the globe are imposing new coronavirus restrictions. Today, Israel's government decided to shut down bars, gyms, and event halls. And in Australia, a shared border is now closed between the states of New South Wales and Victoria as cases spike there.
And things were going so well in Australia. Well, here in the U.S., there are COVID-19 hotspots in several states, including Arizona. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego told ABC News yesterday that the state reopened too soon.
We were one of the last states to go to stay at home and one of the first to reemerge, and we reemerged at 0 to 60. We had crowded nightclubs handing out free champagne, no masks. Our 20 to 44-year-olds, which is my own demographic, really led the explosion, and we've seen such growth in that area.
Joining us now is Saskia Popescu, who's an epidemiologist at the University of Arizona. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And do you agree with the mayor of Phoenix there about the reasons for the spikes that you're seeing in Arizona?
I definitely do. Mayor Gallego really hit the nail on the head in terms of Arizona not only reopened too early, but so quickly. Most states of, like Washington, have really worked hard to do it slowly over several weeks or months to make sure that they're not stressing public health and healthcare systems, versus Arizona let the stay-at-home orders expire on May 15th, and then within about a week, everything was open. So it was very prematurely and very rapidly.
How much does the fact that Arizona is extremely hot at this time of year have to do with what you're seeing? In other words, people in the Northeast, for example, it's easier to dine outside or get together outside than it is in a place where it's 110 degrees. And I think that's in some places in Arizona, it's more than 110 degrees today. Is that causing more of a problem there?
I definitely think it impacts behavior. You know, there was so much questioning of if this was going to be a seasonal bug. But realistically, we knew that the human factors associated with heat in the summer can be very impacting. So in Arizona, as you mentioned, when it's 110 degrees outside, people are not going to be eating outside. I mean, at midnight, it's over 100 degrees out. So that really complicates efforts to tell people to stay outside or exercise outside. And ultimately, in the summer is when we're all mostly indoors because it is so hot. So people are flocking indoors, and that's not just in their own homes, but also to movie theaters or restaurants and bars, which, you know, thankfully have recently been closed, but also things like casinos, which are actually still open in Arizona. So those kinds of environments can really be a source for transmission, as we know that close contact for a prolonged period of time in close quarters can definitely, you know, potentially lead to exposure and transmission.
Well, you're also dealing with a situation in Arizona where when you are indoors, you've got air conditioners circulating some of the same air. You've been thinking a lot about this idea of aerosol transmission. What have you learned about that?
Well, and this is such a complex topic, and I think, unfortunately, we've done a poor job at really communicating that. So we know that ventilation is a good thing. You want air to be moving and exhausted and recirculated. Filters are an important piece of this, and stagnant air is where we worry the most. But really what it comes down to is if you're in a room with several other people for hours at a time with very little air circulation, that's what could potentially lead to, you know, we say super spreader events, but realistically, even if you're 6 feet apart and you're in that area for a prolonged period of time with people unmasked, that's when we have events occur. That's when exposures occur. So we know that aerosolization can occur, and that can lead to, you know, exposure beyond that 6 foot, especially in certain situations. So ACs are important. We want air ventilation and filtration, but we also still need to be mindful that if you're going to be in there for hours at a time, you know, be mindful of how many people you're interacting with and wear a mask.
What about the testing situation in Arizona at this point? How problematic is that from your standpoint?
That's tough. I mean, I think we've definitely improved testing capabilities in Arizona and really in the U.S. But unfortunately, with so many people going to get tested, there are definitely delays. You know, I've heard of a few days to even a week or so. You know, I personally have friends who have been waiting 10 days for their test results. And I think that's really challenging. So much of this is testing facilities being overwhelmed and then delays in notification, which we know can be really challenging, not only for public health efforts, but because when you go get tested at an outpatient clinic, whether that's like a pharmacy or an urgent care, I'm reliant on you to stay home and isolate yourself and act as if you are infectious and not necessarily wait for that positive result, which is really asking a lot of people and very much dependent upon them. So that delay can definitely be challenging. And, you know, we know that improving testing capabilities only helps the situation.
We saw something like 3,500 new cases yesterday reported in the state of Arizona. We're seeing numbers like that each day right now. As you look forward, because once you have a case reported, then it could be a couple weeks before it gets serious enough to see a hospitalization, and then it could be even longer before it's serious enough possibly to lead to a death. How long do you think, based on what you're seeing now, is Arizona going to be in real crisis mode?
It's really tough to say. I mean, you know, when we implemented community-based mask mandates, I think people assumed right away it was going to have an impact. But we know interventions like those take at least a couple of weeks to see any changes. So right now and in the next 2 to 3 weeks is when it's going to be very telling. You know, you mentioned we had 3,500 new cases. That to me is actually quite low. And we know that on the weekends there is a reporting lull. So I'm hoping as Arizona really focuses on closing high-risk areas like bars and movie theaters and focusing on community-based mask wearing, it's important for people to be vigilant in that, but also patient, because we know it does take time. And this is the time we need to really ensure that hospitals and public health infrastructure isn't overwhelmed and we're giving them time to, you know, kind of ease that burden a little bit.
That is Saskia Popescu, an epidemiologist at the University of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, now to Washington and a unanimous ruling today from the Supreme Court, which upheld laws against so-called faithless electors. Those are the Electoral College delegates who break their pledge to vote for the presidential candidate who wins the popular vote in their state. The court now says it is constitutional for states to penalize those electors. NPR Washington correspondent Brian Naylor has been looking into the court's decisions today, and he joins us now. Brian, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Peter.
Sure, and let's start with the Electoral College opinion, which says, and I'm reading here, a state may enforce an elector's pledge to support his party's nominee and the state voter's choice for president. Tell me more. What does that mean?
So, as you noted, it was a unanimous decision, and Justice Elena Kagan wrote the opinion. She stated very clearly that the ruling, quote, reflects a longstanding tradition in which electors are not free agents. They are to vote for the candidate whom the state's voters have chosen. So just to back up a bit, there were a handful of electors in Washington state and Colorado in the last presidential election who were pledged to vote for Hillary Clinton, who won their state's popular vote. But instead, they voted for Republicans, Colin Powell and John Kasich. They said they did this in an effort to convince other electors to support someone other than Donald Trump. The electors in Washington who did this were fined $1,000, and the elector in Colorado was replaced, and then they sued to challenge their state's laws. A federal appeals court in Denver upheld the challenge, but the Supreme Court today reversed it and said its ruling would apply to the Washington case as well. There are 32 states in all, and Washington, D.C., that bind electors to vote for the popular vote winner in their states. So in essence, these laws have now been all upheld.
And what do you think this means for the election in November?
Well, you know, there were maybe 10 faithless electors in the last election. But, you know, we've seen twice in the last 20 years that where the winner of the electoral vote didn't win the popular vote. So in a very close election, it could conceivably affect the outcome. And with the 2020 election in under 4 months, there was a concern that there would be electoral chaos if the high court ruled electors were free agents. But that scenario now seems to have been avoided by this decision today.
Brian, in a separate ruling, good news today for people who hate getting robocalls on their cell phone.
Right.
The court upheld a 1991 law that bars robocalls on cell phones. What else did we learn?
Well, sure. If there's one thing that Americans agree on, it's that these computer-generated robocalls are a nuisance. And as you pointed out, Congress banned them, at least to cell phones. But a few years ago, lawmakers created an exemption allowing government debt collectors to make them. And then a group of political consultants challenged the exemption, saying essentially, hey, if the government can make these calls, why can't we make, say, political calls? So in the ruling today, the court determined that the government exemption was unconstitutional, but it let the overall law stand. So basically, neither government debt collectors nor anyone else is supposed to be making robocalls to your cell phone.
They're not supposed to, but as everyone knows, it still happens. Look, Brian, I know there's at least one more major case out there that we're still waiting for. What can you tell us about that?
Well, so yeah, there are a couple that relate to the president's finances. One is whether congressional panels can subpoena the president's financial and business records. Another is whether the Manhattan District Attorney can obtain the president's tax returns as part of a state grand jury investigation. There's also a ruling expected on whether the Trump administration can allow employers to limit women's access to free birth control under the Affordable Care Act.
All right, we're going to keep an eye on those cases. NPR's Brian Naylor, thank you very much.
Thanks, you.
As nationwide protests continue over racial injustice, many cities are reconsidering how they fund and operate police departments. Cities like Minneapolis have cited one program in particular as a possible alternative. It's called CAHOOTS, or Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, based out of Eugene, Oregon. The program turned 31 years old this weekend, and supporters say it saves money and lives. Brian Bull of member station KLCC reports.
Crisis worker Kimber Hawes dashes through the rain towards a large van sporting a logo for the White Bird Clinic. She checks in with medic Daniel Feltz.
We're going to transport a potentially suicidal subject to University District.
Okay.
The CAHOOTS van pulls into a parking lot across town. Police cars and a fire engine surround a sedan. Eugene Police Officer Roberto Rios greets Haas and Feltz and walks them toward a teenage girl who sits coiled up in the back seat. As her parents watch on, Rios explains the situation.
She basically got cited for stealing something over at the mall.
Uh-huh.
They were heading home, I guess, and then she made some kind of statements like she wanted her cell phone. If you don't give me my cell phone, I'm going to kill myself. And at one point, she grabbed the handle of the car to jump out of a moving car. The medics have been talking to her.
Okay.
Oz kneels next to the girl and softly talks to her for 20 minutes. The girl then steps into the CAHOOTS van to be driven to a nearby hospital. Haas says she gave the distraught teen a choice between going in their van or inside a police car, where she'd be required to wear handcuffs.
With us, we can provide more therapeutic space, maybe offer to put on music for the patient, like heat up the back of the van compartment, provide them with a feeling of freedom and choice, even when maybe they're going to the hospital on a police hold.
Neither Haas nor Feltz carry weapons or restraints. Their attire is casual jackets and jeans. The aim is not to intimidate, but rather counsel and de-escalate situations fraught with anxiety, tension, or despair, and provide an alternative to jail time.
We're total hippies. We don't like when people get arrested. It's not like a fun experience for anybody. If we can connect someone to resources or help them have a more supportive evening, we're going to do that every time over jail. And I think Eugene police are 99.9% of the time on the same page. They don't want to take people to jail that are dealing with gaps in services or mental health issues.
CAHOOTS and Eugene police share a deep appreciation for each other. The partnership allows CAHOOTS to address emergency calls where someone's mental well-being is threatened, such as suicide risks, overdoses, or emotional breakdowns. This allows law enforcement to focus on actual crimes. Again, Officer Rios.
I remember patrolling the city of Eugene before we had CAHOOTS, and we have to do a lot of what they're doing to assist us now. They're awesome, and we enjoy talking to them and able to use their resources because they have a lot of resources that a lot of times that we as police officers don't have.
Satisfy the girls being taken care of at the hospital, Kimber and Haas resume their six-hour shift. CAHOOTS operates on a $2 million annual budget, which funds 40 staffers and a small fleet of vans. It's been heralded as an effective alternative to traditional policing. Operations coordinator Tim Black says they've consulted more than a dozen municipalities since they were mentioned by Minneapolis city councilors after the death of George Floyd.
It is a little surreal. Over 30 years ago, our city demonstrated one potential outcome of reallocating public safety funds. To that extent, we have a lot to offer in lessons learned from, you know, a smaller college town that could be scaled up to some of these larger metropolitan areas.
One convert is the city of Denver. Earlier this month, the city launched a taxpayer-funded program called Support Team Assisted Response, or STAR. Vinny Cervantes is organizing director for the Denver Alliance for Street Health Response, which pushed for the new service.
I think that we'll have a more treatment-focused lens rather than punitive lens. I think that will directly result in seeing less people in jail, less violence between police and community members. I think that we'll have other approaches that include more expansion of treatment rather than punishment, and I think that that would expand even beyond just a CAHOOTS model.
STAR is in a six-month pilot phase focused on central downtown Denver. If all goes well, it'll expand citywide. Olympia, Washington, Portland, Oregon, and Victoria, British Columbia are among the other cities looking at developing programs that follow the CAHOOTS model. In Eugene, Tim Black says CAHOOTS handled 20% of 911 calls last year, which comes to more than 24,000 calls, with a budget far smaller than if police responded to them.
Finances are something that are really easy for folks to latch onto because that makes sense. There's not a lot of feeling involved in that. Numbers are what they are. But what we're talking about here is bigger than that. You know, what we're talking about is really finding a way to have a more compassionate response for folks when they're in that moment of need.
Police are still on hand should a CAHOOTS call turn dangerous. But teams say that's rare. They say by assigning the appropriate response to each situation, safety and wellness come out ahead. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
Well, over the weekend, there was a much-anticipated release from Disney Plus with an eye towards history.
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
Hamilton the movie is the filmed version of the hugely popular hip-hop Broadway musical about founding father Alexander Hamilton. But amid the debates about racism in America and historical figures, the movie is coming out at a very different time than the stage musical did. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, has been thinking about this, and he joins us from Washington. You watched Hamilton over the weekend. How is it being received today compared to when it first came out in 2015?
Well, when it came out at first, it was this earth-shaking phenomenon. People hadn't seen anything like it before. And the movie can't recapture that literal dynamic because now tens of thousands of people have seen it. But the official reviews have been really good. As an actor myself, I thought that it was rendered in a really beautiful way. It's very difficult to film stage theater, but I thought they did a wonderful job rendering it. At the same time, because we're in this moment where there is this much earned, much needed, and very controversial debate around social justice, it was filtered through a new lens in 2020 than it was in 2015, for sure.
Well, there's, of course, a debate about whether Hamilton was depicted accurately and whether he and other founding fathers are being over-glorified. Tell us more about that and what the issue is there.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the criticism has to do with the fact that this is a musical that needs a relatively simple protagonist and a simple antagonist. And the truth is, of course, more messy. Hamilton appears in this musical much more virtuous than he was in real life as a uncomplicated hero of the early Republic. Burr appears much worse, I think, in the musical than he was in real life, and where he had lots of really important accomplishments that historians are constantly pointing to. Jefferson, much more loquacious, again, much more simple in the musical than he was in real life. But the biggest issue I think that a lot of historians today are talking about when it comes to Hamilton the musical is that the musical itself pretty much skirts the issue of slavery, and that makes a lot of them a little bit upset.
What about the fans who are defending this and saying, no, come on, Hamilton is brilliant, and what's wrong with watching it on TV just as so many people did on the stage?
Yeah, I would summarize the debate this way. I think there's a lot of people who say, look, this is a musical that is based on a book written by a white man, Ron Chernow, and the book and the musical itself erase the black experience. There isn't a lot of mentions of slavery. The Schuyler family, the Schuyler sisters own slaves. That's not mentioned in the play itself. Meanwhile, I think you have a lot of fans who are looking at this and saying, look, this channels aesthetically a representation of the United States that I want to believe in. It's a vision of America that is optimistic, that is pro-founder, that still feels like the values that this country was founded on are virtuous, and yet also does so in a way that is racially inclusive. And so I think that that's really the debate that's going on right now online, is between people who want to focus, you know, very sensibly on the history of slavery in the 1700s versus those who want who cherish the musical for being an optimistic representation of the values they want to remember in the founding.
You know, I have to imagine that just as, you know, when one statue of Robert E. Lee gets looked at in a different way, that so many other statues of different people do as well, that when we're talking about Hamilton, something that was such a huge success over the last several years, and looking at that in a different way, we're going to start to do that with a lot of movies, books, music. What's the bigger picture here?
Well, there's two things that are going on. You know, one thing that's going on is I tweeted about this, that there's this thing called Laver's Law, which says that lots of popular entertainment from 1 to 10 years ago tends to be reappraised, and it seems, you know, dowdy or hideous compared to current values. What's happening here, though, is a little bit more complex. It's not just Laver's Law. It's not just the fact that the art from a few years ago is seems more old-fashioned or seems of a different time. It's that we're also experiencing a really important national conversation, this sort of, you know, revolution in thinking about the way that we talk about the founding of this country and the way that we include, you know, non-white Americans in that narrative of talking about the founding of this country. So I think it's a healthy conversation, and I think it's great that conversation can be held under what is really a complex and brilliant musical.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Army investigators have identified the remains of 20-year-old Specialist Vanessa Guillen, who went missing from Fort Hood in Texas more than 2 months ago. Her family's lawyer, Natalie Kawam, spoke with NPR last week.
The story, unfortunately, is a nightmare that we were afraid of what happened. We knew she didn't run away. We knew she didn't, you know, wasn't hiding in a closet anywhere. We knew that there was something horrible going to happen because she felt very uncomfortable about these men sexually harassing her at the base.
Jolene Almendarez is a freelance reporter with Texas Public Radio, and she joins us now on a Skype line. Jolene, of course, finding the remains will provide some closure for this family, but it's also a key step in the investigation. What's the latest?
So the FBI says that Guillen was murdered at the base, and at least one person has been arrested. One of the two suspects in the case died by suicide on July 1st after officials say that he fled the base. And then the other woman, her name is Cecily Aguilar. She's in custody, and she's being charged with helping mutilate and hide the body. It's pretty shocking. And then this weekend is when the news actually broke that the body found near a river that was very close to the base was actually Vanessa Guillen.
Wow. So the family, as we heard through the lawyer, has said that her disappearance, they think, is linked to sexual harassment that she suffered on the base. The Army says they saw no evidence of this. What do we know about those claims and any possible motive at all?
Right. So the suspect who's deceased, Aaron Robinson, who's 20, he was a fellow soldier at the base. The family says that he was sexually harassing Vanessa. She apparently told her mother about it. She also told her mother that she was being sexually harassed by at least one other person and also stalked by that person. The military says that they have interviewed over 300 people, put in over 10,000 hours into the investigation, and they say they've found no evidence proving that she was sexually harassed. So that's kind of where it's at right now.
Regardless of where this investigation leads, there's no doubt that the case has launched a movement. Survivors of sexual harassment in the military have started sharing their own stories. And you've reported on vigils and marches in Texas over the weekend where these themes came up. Why do you think this case is resonating so deeply?
Right. Well, the number one thing that I've been seeing at these vigils and marches are just former military veterans, men and women, speaking out about the rape culture in the military. Some of them have experienced their own traumas. A lot of people who spoke over this weekend talked about how they'd been raped or sexually assaulted. I had one woman tell me that sexual harassment happens every single day, and she's an Army veteran. And so a lot of people are seeing Vanessa's story and thinking that if something had been done to stop this kind of culture, that she still might be here.
In fact, the League of United Latin American Citizens has said that Latinas should not join the military because it isn't safe for them. Do you see any possibility for reforms because of this case?
So the demonstrators certainly do. They're calling to have sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment all taken out of the chain of command. They want to see an independent third-party organization handle complaints of sexual crimes.
Jolene Almendarez is a freelance reporter with Texas Public Radio with an update on this terrible story. The remains of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen were found over the weekend. Jolene, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Harvard announced today that all instruction will be delivered online for the entire academic year coming up, and it's inviting only 40% of its undergraduates to live on campus. Other colleges are deciding whether they'll do something similar, but either way, incoming freshmen are going to have a very different kind of college experience this year. High school students looking at applying to college are also facing a lot of uncertainty. Lisa Maselli joins us now. She's director of college counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School, my high school in Urbana, Illinois. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, and lots to talk about, and let's start with testing because it's different this year. The SAT canceled spring test dates. Tests won't be offered again until the fall. The ACT is offering limited summer dates, but many colleges, including the University of California system, UT Austin, Princeton, Stanford, have decided that they won't require them for admission, at least for the next year. What does this mean for college applicants? Should they be concerned about taking these tests?
That's a great question, because this is the time of year where the rising seniors, so this year's class of 2021, would always be diligently doing test prep. Now, you have to kind of decide, is it worth it? I have been counseling students to say, look, the reality is if you can call every college, really get an answer, you may not have to study for these at all. You may find out not needed. But the reality is things change daily. So unless they really are 100% sure where they're applying, I don't know. I've been telling some students it's not necessarily a bad thing if you just have an insurance policy. Do 3-4 hours a week of some testing, prep on your own, maybe take some practice exams. But as a rising senior, Jeremy, would I want to study for exams not even knowing if they're going to be needed or not? I'd probably start calling colleges and doing my research to see if my return on investment of time is even needed.
It sounds like it's making it a lot more difficult from what you're saying for students right now, not knowing, between colleges what they're going
to
do.
Right. I mean, I have to say as a high school counselor, what I love to just hear everyone say, test optional for the class of 2021. The uncertainty is being relieved by some colleges, but it's still kind of being dragged along by others. But I think they're going to try to have those conversations to say in the best interest of these students who have faced literally the most unique educational circumstances in our history, are these exams really needed when the whole goal of admissions is to build a vibrant class of students? You know, we've talked before about how testing is so controversial anyway. I think this is the time for this to be very much dissected by every admissions officer to decide how valuable is this data for us.
Speaking of uncertainty, the other thing we don't know in a lot of cases is whether colleges are going to be open in the fall on campus or whether they're going to be having people attend online classes. How is that affecting students and their decisions about where they'll go and whether they'll go and whether they want to defer their admission to college?
So the majority of students either had to decide by May 1 or if the college extended to June 1, June 15th to send off that deposit to a school. The colleges have been offering lots of grace and patience with students to say, look, we realize that even as the summer evolves, you may start rethinking things, potentially even want to do a gap year. So they're expecting what they call sometimes the summer slide regarding losing students over the summer. But I have to say, for the colleges that I have been on webinars with and have received updates from, they were over-predicting lots of gap year requests. And that really hasn't happened. Students are anxious to know, is this going to be a combination of hybrid learning? Will I be home and then on campus at certain points? If they do try to do a hybrid learning environment, Jeremy, the question has become, Do we maybe bring freshmen back just for fall semester? And sophomores and juniors stay home and learn online? What about housing? They want a room now with only one person in a room instead of having roommates. Everyone is just waiting to see what's going to happen in fall, so unfortunately students and families just have to be patient, keep in touch with the colleges, call them anytime they feel anxious, because the colleges are there to help them. Nobody wants to have a student feel like they are captive and stuck going to a college if things in their life are changing and they're starting to question their decision.
Well, do you think that COVID-19 is going to make college admissions more competitive with colleges admitting fewer students next year?
Right now, colleges are not predicting that at all. They're not predicting that it's going to be a more rigorous admission cycle for this new application round. I'm hoping now if students can de-emphasize the testing pressure and focus on once again exploring who they are at their core and how colleges will allow them to grow and thrive, that this can be a win-win for everybody.
We are in the middle of the summer at this point, which is a time when a lot of students who are heading to college might do a summer job or an internship or play sports. Of course, a lot of that has changed. A lot of that has been canceled. What should students be doing to make the most of this summer, especially if colleges and universities are looking at what they are doing and judging them based on what they're doing?
You know, that's an excellent question, because so many students had bought into that mindset as if summer had to be a formally entered, you know, item on their resume. And if something that was now on their agenda or they had applied for has now been canceled, there's that mentality as if, oh my gosh, I'm going to look weaker because that experience has now been eliminated for me. What I want students to remember is summer itself has not been canceled. Maybe a summer job didn't come to fruition. Maybe that camp you were going to go to learn bioengineering now had to be canceled. Curiosity cannot be stopped. Students now have to be more creative. But what I don't want to happen is students to have this pressure on them now as if, oh my gosh, in the summer of COVID-19, I have to prove that I've changed the world. Or I have to make sure that I have sewn 3,000 masks because I'm sure everyone else is.
Or come up with a cure for COVID-19.
Thank you. Right. Or to literally feel like now I better get into some virtual research lab and show that I'm working on a cure. So what they really have to do is just think about, is there something new I'd like to try? Is there a joy that I'd like to rekindle? And basically just find ways to prove you are finding ways to engage with your own curiosities and your growth.
Let's talk about finances, because tens of millions of Americans have lost their jobs over the last few months, temporarily or permanently. Obviously, many of those people are going to be parents of students, and maybe some of those students were headed off to college. Have the universities been helpful in terms of helping people adjust to changing financial situations?
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say, it's even been offering and extending even more grace to those families, because if, for instance, let's say the college had a June 1 reply date, but the family was in conversations with them, or they needed to have a letter from their employer to explain changes in their employment status, colleges have been extending that deadline and saying, look, if we need to work on appealing financial aid with you through the summer, we are willing to work with you on that. The number one goal of colleges, especially with financial aid, is to always focus on who are the neediest families who need to come. So I don't want to speak on behalf of all colleges. I'm sure there are some students and families listening who may have had to let go of a dream school because of the financial new reality of their family and maybe ended up going to a different school. Community colleges have seen a surge because of all of these financial woes.
Finally, let me just ask you, as students at your high school, my high school, ended the school year and had to do their graduation virtually and had to, you know, just do things in a weird way. How was that? How did they handle that?
Again, it was nice to be together virtually. It never, ever could replace what the ceremony is and what it means to our students and to our faculty and families. So I know that for us to at least acknowledge and give them their yard signs and make sure that they felt celebrated and seen I think that that was appreciated by everybody. But absolutely, we are a school that is talking about when and how we will do a full ceremony that replicates all of the traditions that we're known for at our school so that every student goes through what they were looking forward to, and crossing our fingers that there'll be a time that we can actually announce when that can be.
That is Lisa Maselli, the Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois. Lisa, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Actors, musicians, and stagehands are often independent contractors, and many of them have seen their incomes dry up during the pandemic. Some are getting help from an organization that dates back to the 19th century, the Actors Fund. As Jeff London reports, the group has adapted to the moment.
Lori Vodnoy Wright had a busy schedule as a freelance violinist. She played with the Chamber Orchestra of Sarasota, Florida. She gave recitals at museums. She played for Alzheimer's patients in nursing homes. And then, in the middle of March, that abruptly stopped.
It was a very scary time. It's still a scary time.
With bills to pay and no foreseeable income, her union gave Vodnoy Wright a list of potential sources of relief, and she wrote to the Actors Fund.
And these lovely people responded on an email, and I was almost taken aback because they were so kind and they were calm. That's the most important thing. Their calmness and almost like a virtual hug. It's okay. You'll be okay. You'll be okay.
She got a check for $1,000.
In a normal year, we would give away about $2 million to probably about 200 different people coming for emergency financial assistance.
But Tony Award-winning actor Brian Stokes Mitchell, who chairs the Actors Fund, says it's not a normal year.
Since March 18th of 2020, the Actors Fund has distributed over $13 million in emergency financial assistance.
And that number is growing. The Actors Fund was established in 1882 by Buffalo Bill Cody and actor Edwin Booth. Yes, he was the brother of John Wilkes Booth, to help members of the entertainment industry in need. And over the years, it's run health centers, retirement home, residences. But the Emergency Financial Assistance Program has expanded dramatically since the pandemic began.
That would include things like helping somebody pay for their health insurance, helping somebody pay for their rent, helping somebody buy food sometimes. It comes down to that. And the Actors Fund is for anyone in the entertainment community that's worked professionally. So it's not just actors, it's singers, it's dancers, it's musicians, it's editors, it's boom operators, it's producers, it's camera people, it's anybody.
One of the more than 11,000 people the fund has helped out since the beginning of the pandemic is L.A.-based television and film actor Scott Vance.
So, to be clear, you saw Mr. Ellison materialize out of this energy bubble, completely nude.
That's Vance in an episode of Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
In general, I never know where my next job is going to be, and I never know when I'm going to get my next residual check for the commercial or the TV show or whatever the case may be.
With a load of debt and the rent coming due, Vance approached the Actors Fund for emergency assistance, and they gave him $1,500. In Austin, Texas, stagehand Jeffrey Herring, who works live events like South by Southwest, was even more desperate. He injured his hand in November, worked through the pain, but needed surgery, which of course was delayed by the pandemic. By late April, Herring says,
thousands of dollars in medical bills arrived. Utility bills and my house payment were about due, and still not a penny of income. I used the last of my reserves to pay the surgeon his required fee, leaving me wondering how I would pay the surgery center's portion.
The Actors Fund ponied up the $2,435 fee on the day Herring's surgery was scheduled, and he's now recovering.
Can't stop the beat.
You can't stop an avalanche as it races down the hill.
Part of the reason the Actors Fund can provide this assistance is because performers have been donating online entertainment to encourage viewers to chip in, to the tune of close to $22 million in the last few months, and the tune of You Can't Stop the Beat, sung by actors who've performed in Hairspray. Or You've Got a Friend from the musical Beautiful, including songwriter Carol King.
You've got a friend.
Brian Stokes Mitchell is proud of how the entertainment community has stepped up to help its members in need.
To hear the kind of responses that the fund is getting, thanks to the work of the staff and volunteers, that kind of puts things in a really beautiful focus, particularly at a time when everybody needs help.
Or, as violinist Lori Vodnoy Wright might say, a virtual hug and a helpful check. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And some sad news in the entertainment industry. Broadway actor Nick Cordero has died after a three-month battle with COVID-19. Cordero earned a Tony nomination for his role in the musical Bullets Over Broadway. He also appeared in Waitress and A Bronx Tale. His wife, Amanda Klutz, announced his death on social media, saying God has another angel in heaven now. Nick Cordero was just 41.